a restaurant and meeting place located in downtown Jamestown. Open Wednesday to Sunday, the Jamestown Mercantile maintains a calendar of events of its live music schedule. More information can be found at jamestownmercantile.com.
KGNU presents the 35th Annual Charles Sautel Memorial Mountain Jam, Sunday, July 16th at Gold Hill Inn, featuring Jake Legg, Pine Creek Cajun Band, and the Cody Sisters. It's a family-friendly mini-festival of bluegrass and Americana music for fans who enjoy clear mountain air with homegrown music in a spectacular outdoor setting. Gather friends and family and join us for a day of barbecue, beverages, music, and memories. Get tickets now at kgnu.org.
Good evening, gentle listeners. Thanks for tuning in to your community radio station, KGNU. It's just past 6 p.m. Time now for It's the Economy, our weekly look into financial things of impact on a grassroots community level. I'll be your host for this evening's show, Dave Ashton, here live and direct from KGNU's Denver studio. And tonight's program, we're going to be looking at two documentaries which are making their debut here in the Front Range. The second half of the show, we will be talking to the activists behind the film High Country, which is all about the Crested Butte community and their struggles with mining companies looking to infiltrate and work inside of their community. But here, before we get to that conversation, we're going to talk about the film, which is, Healing U.S. This is making its Denver debut next Tuesday, July 18th, at the Alamo Draft House at Sloan Lake. It is narrated by Susan Sarandon, and within this film, Healing U.S. makes the case that the American healthcare system should be accessible to all through a single-payer system. The film provides arguments for universal healthcare from the standpoint of liberals, conservatives, doctors, public health officials, ex-insurance executives, families who have suffered greatly under our current system, veterans, patients, and all alike, really touching on all angles of our society. So we have our incredible group here who's put this film together, pushing it out, making this summertime trek across the country, releasing the films. I'd like to introduce members of the Red Berets, Medicare for All community, and Maddie Purvis, Sarah Wright. Hello. Welcome to KGNU this evening. Oh, I'm sorry, Maddie. My button was pushed. But anyways, thank you so much for being here. We've all done this very short notice. This has just kind of landed, and we've shifted some things around on tonight's show so that we could bring you on before Tuesday's premiere at Denver's Alamo Draft House. Give us a little bit of background on how this film came together. It really captures, I think, a lot of energy of what was happening in this country during the COVID pandemic. Tell us a little bit about how the whole project came off the ground.
Sure. Well, the director, Kenny Ballantyne, like many of us in the middle of COVID, found themselves without healthcare and with a lot of needs for healthcare, and heard of the story of these awesome women in the West Coast, the Red Berets, and their craftivism, sewing and knitting Red Berets for healthcare. Initially, Kenny thought that would be a cute 30-minute short, but immediately the story unraveled and it was a larger thing. And Laura Fielding, here on the show with us tonight, was instrumental in kind of gathering a network of activists from around the country with different perspectives And the effort became very clear that this was a film and a story that needed to be told, that healthcare as a human right is a belief shared by all kinds of Americans. And COVID is uniting us in, for better or worse, in this movement that the time is now for some sort of universal healthcare. And turns out many people in Washington, in Colorado, in California, where I'm at, in New York, there are plans and there are coalitions of people getting healthcare on the ballot. And that became the larger story, and it turned into a really wonderful, beautiful film centered on the American experience in our kind of broken healthcare system.
So it really comes from a grassroots perspective. The Red Berets.
Absolutely.
The Red Berets is, as you mentioned, it's craftivism. It's a knitting circle that has gone, into activism and really trying to raise the profile of this importance, this message of Medicare for all. So, Laura Fielding, tell us a little bit about how your propensity to put the needles together and make hats has really fueled a movement.
Yeah. Hello. Thank you so much for inviting me to join this panel. It came from the Women's March, from the sort of aerial views, as you saw in the film. I mentioned the aerial views of the pink hats, and then about 9 months after that first inaugural march, which would have been in the fall of 2017, is when I was listening to Bernie Sanders and Roseanne DeMauro, not live, but kind of it was a recording of them addressing the National Nurses United. And suddenly I started thinking of these pink hats and thought, wow, what if we should be knitting some hats? Because I was thinking of these aerial views and thought, how stunning would it be if we could all be united for national improved Medicare for all? So I just, and then I thought, you know, a beret, because I served some time in the military, and my husband did as well. And we actually lived over in the UK for 7.5 years, and I went to school there, and I had so many student colleagues who worked within the NHS, the National Health System, who would say, how can you stand to serve a country that leaves so many behind? And that was really a formative experience for me. So that kind of planted the seeds even prior to being awakened by Bernie. But anyway, I set to work in earnest the fall of 2017, knit my first beret, posted it in some Facebook groups just with the hashtag Knit for Nurses and the 99%. And, I had several people reaching out and contacting. I just want to say, since this is Colorado and we're coming to show this in Denver, you know, the Colorado Universal Healthcare for Colorado were some of the very first people who online recognized this idea as really, really awesome. And I think that they also resonated with that I got drawn in locally to starting to gather signatures for whole Washington, because of course Colorado are the pioneers of gathering signatures to try to get universal healthcare. But that's not for mine to talk about. But it's just a very special place in my heart to be able to visit Denver and bring some handcrafted red berets, because Colorado people wore red berets at a Nurses Day event some years back, because they had been inspired by the idea. So it's kind of come full circle, and I'll have my knitting needles with me, and I'm very excited to be coming to Denver.
So what you're mentioning about, you know, how it is a ding, more than a ding, an incredible damage in our national psyche, the fact that our entire healthcare industry is for profit, and it is based upon making money for shareholders instead of taking care of the health of the people, that it is actually, you know, the people's illness that is being exploited for profit. And give us some of the the figures of like how much money is being made in our for-profit industry, but not really like made like earned, but like how much money is being diverted into people's health care that could potentially, if our government was providing for its citizens, how much of a bite is this taking out of everyone's like livelihoods?
Absolutely. Yeah. So it was just an incredible, you know, surprise, honor. I couldn't believe it when Kenny reached out and, we'd been involved, but people were sending red berets to us from, Grand Rapids, from Florida. So although many of us did start out in Washington State, it's really been an effort that people across the country had started crafting these. And so when Kenny reached out and they said, you know, we'd like to do a documentary, or has there been a documentary about the Red Berets movement? I was just flabbergasted and really excited because, as people may know, it's very difficult to get independent media to cover things. You know, they don't cover healthcare, the Medicare for All movement fairly, as we know, on corporately owned media. And then to get attention for local efforts, you know, berets were always, you know, just intended to try to unite this national fight because we're all in it to get healthcare for everyone in the country. But then we have activists that are also, you know, trying to work at every single level of government, you know, at the local and state level. So, you know, the creativity of trying to unite and bring together the movement where there's, you know, been arguing about strategy or how do we do this? It's kind of like, let's bring some art and some beauty. And so the film is such a beautiful medium for telling these stories and showing some different ways that, people can become involved. What can we do? I think is the question that's on a lot of people's minds. People are aware of what a crisis that we are in. Many people overwhelmingly know that both of the parties are beholden to corporate interests. The question now is, what do we do in order to come together and raise enough ruckus to solve this problem?
Absolutely. Thank you, Laura. Maddie, I'll punt that question over to you. What is the size, the economic impact of the money that is being spent on healthcare by Americans?
Yeah, well, you hit it on the head that it is a scope issue. And one of the things that we wanted to at least cover in the film was the wide variety and yet the familiarity of the story of being affected by the healthcare industry. If you haven't had a healthcare crisis, you know somebody who has. And if we think about healthcare as including vision, dental, taking care of our disabled and elderly populations, everything is healthcare. Women's rights, you know, there's a huge disparity of race with our healthcare system. Everything is touched on with healthcare. And even just beyond that, everybody has a body and everybody needs water and medicine. And we tried to represent that in the film. Numbers wise, there are a few segments that we include in the film with some cute graphics that I'm very excited about. But they only are there now at this point, even a little outdated and a little undervalued and inaccurate at this point, just because they're from 2020, 2021. And since, as we've seen, as COVID continues and is still a global issue, insurers, health insurance companies, and the people at the top are making more and more money to the tune of billions. And that's we only barely touch on that. Unfortunately, part of what we include shows some columns that compare recent presidents of our country and candidates in the amount in millions of dollars they've taken from the health insurance lobby. And unfortunately, our current president, Biden, is by far and away the winner in terms of taking so much, again, millions and millions of dollars from the health insurance lobby. And we can see that confirmed in the film. We addressed it a few times. And if we think back, I remember when Biden said, I would veto Medicare for All if it came across my desk. So the scope is huge. It's at the very least national. And that is, again, kind of go back to the craft of this. It's a national effort, and it's going to take a national effort to fight it. And that means the people need to rise up, and we can if we do it as simply as picking up a pair of knitting needles or crochet, or picking up your phone and taking a picture of yourself and saying, I am in favor of healthcare for all, and rallying together from a very grassroots perspective, because it is, everybody's affected. It's going to take everybody to do something about it.
Indeed. One of the things that I really enjoyed in the film was the gentleman breaking down the way that, like, market factors are they shouldn't be considered in healthcare, because he really broke out how, like, the Adam Smith, the four pillars of the market, that none of them actually exist. You cannot consider market factors when it comes to healthcare in the same way that, like, so I'm not a diabetic. He says, you can't make insulin cheap enough to make me want to buy it. It's just, or if you are a diabetic, there's really no limit to the price that could be paid, because it is simply needed to live day to day. Sarah Wright, like, can you tell us a little bit, you know, just how the market really fails inside of healthcare?
Oh, sure. Well, for one thing, thank you again for hosting this. We know that the incentive for health insurance companies is to take our money as much as they can as premiums and then deny healthcare. Because the more healthcare they say no to, the more money they make. So right in the middle of everything, in the middle of the healthcare system, right between us and our providers and our doctors, are a bunch of people that don't have medical training. They don't know what the doctors know. And lately, it's even been AI making some of these denials. But the denials are basically just creating a maze for sick people to have to fight through when they're sick to try to get paid, making a maze for doctors who are already busy, to have to make multiple calls to try to get paid. And basically, people are too sick when they're sick to make all the fights, to make all the calls, and they end up surrendering that because they don't have a choice, and the insurance companies win. And people die, as you saw in the film. People die because of this on a regular basis. And that's part of why Wendell Potter, who speaks in the film, who used to do marketing for Cigna as a vice president, speaks to this entire issue. Because he finally was like, I am using my power as a persuader in a way that is killing people. And we have a lot of people that are making so much money from the system as it is, that they are investing huge amounts in lobbying our elected officials, in brainwashing Americans to think that it's socialism to take care of our own people. And yet we know that in the United States, 70% or more want improved Medicare for all. In Colorado, Coloradans are really asking for help with this. It's an urgent issue for many Coloradans. The Colorado Health Foundation just did this survey, the Health Equity Research Project, with an advisory group, with faith-based organizations and racial justice organizations. And they surveyed a bunch of people in Colorado and found that Coloradans feel like some issues are a little intractable, like homelessness feels hard for them to solve. But they believe the healthcare system is broken, and they are optimistic that a solution is possible. And they want the government to bring that solution. And what's so fascinating, we're talking about at the local level, that there's different levels of activism. In the past 2 years, we've had resolutions asking our elected officials, our congressmen for the US level and our Colorado legislators to bring us either national improved Medicare for all or a Colorado universal healthcare plan. And those resolutions have passed in the past 2 years. The city and county of Denver, the city of Fort Collins, the city of Longmont, Larimer County, Boulder County, and even little Jamestown, Colorado. Because these municipalities at the local level are paying so much just to provide healthcare for their people. And they see the devastation to the communities. And we like at the Carta Foundation for Universal Healthcare, we like to say, imagine a healthcare system that cares for us. Imagine our lives, if we could trust, we would be taken care of. And imagine what it would do for our communities, our resilience, our ability to just be less stressed. You know, people are on GoFundMe trying to pay their medical bills. It's just, it's madness.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in to KGNU's It's the Economy, we are talking about the film Healing Us, Healing US, and it is going to be debuting, making its Colorado debut at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema on West Colfax here in Denver coming up next Tuesday. And really, the conversation is so timely, and there's so many devastating. I have to prepare you folks. If you want to see this film, you will be seeing a lot of parents talking about what it was like losing their child with all kinds of just horrible circumstances arising from our insurance situation. Of course, we all know now that most people receive their insurance through their employer, and that this really just kind of staples people in place in their employment situation. And then, you know, employers are incentivized to kind of pay a minimum amount for minimum coverage, because typically the people receiving this coverage are going to have to pay a ton out of pocket in any case. You know, there's a lot of our it creates a tension in the workplace, and it makes it very hard for people to move around at all. So Maddie Purvis, you know, talk a little bit about how what other countries have and what the potential for Medicare for All is for the United States.
Thank you. I'm glad you asked. One thing I'm excited about for our screening next Tuesday is we will have a discussion after the film with T.R. Reid, who I've just met. He's a very, very cool person, and he's written several books about healthcare in America and about healthcare in Japan. Also on the panel will be one of the subjects in the film, Tsukuru Forest, who is a Japanese immigrant. And Japan's also on the mind recently with all the nuclear conversations going on right now. But Japan is an example of a country. Of course, they're smaller, they're an island, but they are able to take care of with the country with the highest percentage of an elderly population. So what we would consider people on Medicare, they have the oldest population. They also have one of the healthiest populations across the board, regardless of age and physical location in the country of Japan. Other countries have, in the, I don't want to say the first world, developed nations have different kinds of systems. Some countries, like Germany, I believe, have a hybrid. But really, our country is different than any other country. So it's kind of, we can look to other countries to see what's worked for them. Australia, England, the NHS. And we have to consider our country and the models we have. With that in mind, I'm kind of excited about the combination of a federal front of Medicare for All from Congress in D.C. and state-based initiatives for local advocacy groups to get together. And like in Colorado, it's working very successfully, as opposed to California, where there's kind of just some frustration. Local activists can get involved and make a difference in their state ballots. And that's kind of another thing that our film talks about that I'm excited to talk about with TR on Tuesday in Denver, is that there is something we can do, and we have to come up with a new model. America is its own bag of worms, and it's going to take a unique solution, really. But we're up for it, and there are solutions out there, and they're happening in counties and states at the same time as Congress.
one of the activists in the film makes a very bold statement to say that change in America never happens through the ballot box, that it comes from popular foment, uprisings. And I know that this was a, you know, being that this reflects a lot of things that were happening during COVID and the pandemic in 2020. Of course, we saw this tremendous uprising and reckoning about racial inequalities and police violence against communities of color. That kind of thing really rattled this community, this world. How can that kind of grassroots uprising happen to force the issue behind, you know, Medicaid for all? And we've just got 4 minutes left and the time is flying by.
Well, I'll be quick then. I'll give a little spiel pitch. Something we're really excited about is in sharing this movie with people. So far, of course, and obviously, our main audience has been people who are already on board with healthcare for all in some form of Medicare and improved Medicare. What that's meant positively is that we've started building a network, and that kind of sparked an idea in our minds of forming, in name only, a virtual network called the Healing Us Network. And it's our strategy, although we invite any strategy. If you're a knitter, join the Red Berets and knit in your state. If you're a social media person, follow us on social media and share our stuff. The idea behind the Healing Us Network is to have a front where people of all different, the bigger federal organization or national organizations like Our Revolution, One Payer States, that have been in the fight for a long time, National Nurses United, et cetera, can have somewhere online, and they have a place to start. The place to start is watch our film. It's online, it's on Amazon, it's on Vimeo. If you use the code Red Berets, you'll get it for half off. Watch the film and then send us an email that you want to join the network. That's it. And the idea there is that we just get together and we talk about healthcare, and with the goal of getting healthcare for all Americans by any means necessary, whether that's on a state level or we get something through Congress. And that's kind of our strategy. I would recommend anybody who is, if you don't want to be official, you don't want your agency on our website, that's fine. Tweet about us. And just tweet about Medicare for All and join your own local if you're a part of the DSA. Talk about healthcare in your political group. If you're at church, talk about how we can take care of the sick and the needy. Figure out a way of getting healthcare in your conversations day to day and join our network. And it's kind of exciting. We've already got states, half a dozen, if not more, joining us. And these are wonderful people who've fighting for healthcare, for healthy living for Americans. It's a wonderful population to be a part of. And it's open and welcoming, and it's time.
Listeners, if you are interested in checking out this film next Tuesday, Healing Us, Healing US, you can find tickets at couniversalhealth.org. And, you know, with that prompt, I can definitely tell you, you will be fired up. You will see people, you know, really struggling for our lives and making sure that the least among us are taken care of. I mean, it's a very calloused situation that we have with the for-profit health industry. So I'd like to thank Laura Fielding, the commander of the Red Berets Medicare for All troops, Maddie Purvis and Sarah Wright for joining us on It's the Economy. Thank you so much for your good work and your continued advocacy.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
We appreciate it so much.
All right. Again, folks, that's at the Alamo Draft House and next Tuesday. And an incredible movement to get behind, the Red Berets. You can start your stitching and become part of the movement. And let's keep on moving here on It's the Economy.
We didn't look
see
upon
you Tuesday
ourselves
night.
Really as
thank you.
Crazy.
Let the dollar circulate, let the dollar circulate, let the dollar circulate, let the dollar circulate.
didn't look upon ourselves really as crazies, except for skiing.
Skiing powder, I mean, it changed my life.
This whole town was founded on immigrants, and I think it's the core of what America was founded on.
It was generally accepted that people would take LSD to go skiing.
We were a town of 500 people, and we were told that probably 8,000 people would be moving to the area. And it just blew us all away, and we were like, no way.
We all loved this place for what it was, but the only way this place was going to survive was with tourism.
I consider every tree here sacred, and we have to fight for it.
Crested Butte, for me, is a microcosm of an American debate. I mean, who do we want to be?
That's the trailer from the new film, High Country, which is the Audience Choice Award winner at the Crested Butte Film Festival, the Colorado Environmental Film Festival, and the Uray International Film Festival. Many acclaims coming for this film, and there will be an opportunity to view High Country in Boulder at the Patagonia store tomorrow, on Friday. And here to tell us all about not only this film, but the community of Crested Butte, which it covers, and some of the important environmental work being done by High Country conservation advocates, I'd like to welcome to It's the Economy Sue Navy, the board president of High Country conservation advocates, and Chad Rich, the executive director. Welcome to KGNU.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
Absolutely. So it's summertime, good time to get out and see a movie. Lots going on all around the town, but just give us a little background about how the High Country conservation advocates came together. Some of that history is covered in this film, but Sue, this is a history that you've lived.
It is, and the history starts back in 1977 in Crested Butte, which was then a pretty idyllic, small, undiscovered town, when along came a big mining company who discovered it in a way that no one ever imagined, and they intended to mine Red Lady for molybdenum. Red Lady is the mountain right next to town that locals revere, and is just a beautiful part of our lives. And we all were not happy about that, and we took action. A small group of people formed High Country Conservation Advocates then, in order to take on this mining company that we didn't know, you know, we didn't know how we were going to do it, but we started, and it 46 years later, we're coming to the conclusion of what seemed to be a never-ending mining struggle.
For molybdenum, this mineral, I would assume, is pretty precious. And what is that, like, struggle entailed on your part as advocates for the land?
Well, we began by taking on the mining company any which way we could. There weren't that many of us, and we didn't have a lot of resources, but we had people who could, we had a mayor named Mitchell who could go to Congress. He was in a wheelchair. I guess in that sense, it really enabled him to get into places where otherwise we might not have been able to. He talked to Congress people, senators, got us some notoriety. The New York Times picked up an article, wrote an article about us. And we threw going away parties for the mining company, AMAX, even though they had no intention of leaving. We had antics and we had professionalism rolled into one, and it somehow worked at the time. Also, the town itself, the government, was opposed to it, and we just kept on kind of thwarting them at every turn. And eventually, in 1981, the first mining company, AMAX, decided to leave, and that had also to do with the fact that the market had dropped on molybdenum, so it wasn't as valuable as you might think. and they didn't see the profitability for what the investment they would have had to make in order to start a mine here with facing the opposition they faced. So they left in 1981.
It's such an interesting story of a community coming together and a very creative community at that. You mentioned antics, and antics are really a big part of this film, High Country. Describe a little bit about, you know, the culture of antics in Crested Butte.
Well, at the time we were young and creative, and we just thought of whatever we thought of turned into a celebration of sorts. And we celebrated Red Lady. We started the first Red Lady Ball, Red Lady Salvation Ball, and now we're coming up on our 46th Red Lady Salvation Ball. And that party itself just drew a lot more attention to the whole issue. And the continuation all these years has kept the issue alive. And even through, you know, you might hear that AMAX left in 1981 and think that was the end, but there were four or five other mining companies who sequentially entered the picture and said, we're going to mine outside your town and you're going to love it. And each time the community said, no, we're not, and we're not going to allow it. And we just kept up the pressure. Here we are. It's a pretty incredible accomplishment. And I can't take total credit. I just happen to have been there all this time, and a lot of other people played a role, very important roles, including politicians, and it really made a difference.
So after this 47 years of struggle, Chad Rich, you're the executive director of High Country Conservation Advocates. Where is this process now? Like, it feels like there's, you know, some big pieces finally about to fall into place.
Yeah, Dave. You know, I think at one point you could be right by calling this a struggle or a battle. And now I think we've moved on to where we can comfortably call it a partnership and a negotiation. We have so many partners working with us. It's not just us. Federal agencies and other local nonprofits are helping to bring this issue to a close. But we at High Country Conservation Advocates identify kind of three major conditions that we need to see met to make sure that Red Lady is mine-free forever with no chance of something happening in the future. And that first condition we're referring to as no mining on Red Lady. No mining on Red Lady consists of a land swap. So essentially, within the boundaries of the mining area, there are claims owned by a mining company, and then there's U.S. forest land. Essentially, the United States Forest Service is willing to give the claim or the land that is still theirs within the boundaries of the mining area to the mining company. So the mining company will control the entire boundary of what we call Red Lady Bull. And they're doing this because as soon as that happens, we will see a land swap go in.
And it's not just a gift from the Forest Service. It's a land exchange. And the Forest Service, in exchange, gets public land that the mining company currently owns. And it's equivalent in value, more or less, and is beautiful what's going to be public land. So it's a good trade. And then the mining claim areas and the wastewater treatment plant that's been in operation since 1981 will be managed by the Colorado Department of Health and Environment rather than the Forest Service. So still a good management regimen.
So it seems interesting at first. Can we shut that off?
I can't.
Okay. I hope it's not bothering too much. Okay. So it seems interesting at first that everyone's comfortable giving the entire mining boundary to the mining company, but it wouldn't be possible to do the full land, or it wouldn't be possible to put in a conservation easement over the entire boundary unless one person owned it. And if it wasn't private. So it becomes private land. The conservation easement goes in. And within the conservation easement, there's something called the mineral extinguishment over the ore body. The ore body being the molybdenum. And the mineral extinguishment is the company essentially saying, we no longer lay rights to this body of ore. But it's only good for one company, the company that's there now. So if a new company moved in, that wouldn't also apply to them. And that's why we need the second condition, which we call the mineral withdrawal. And a mineral withdrawal is the removal of new claims within a certain boundary. So the Forest Service or the BLM would never be able to issue, or for a certain period of time or forever, wouldn't be able to issue new mining claims. There are two ways that we could achieve a mineral withdrawal. One is called a legislative mineral withdrawal. And a legislative mineral withdrawal is good forever, or unless Congress acts on it. But for the sake of this conversation, let's just say it's good forever. So the legislative mineral withdrawal is actually baked into something called the CORE Act, the Colorado Outdoor Resource Economy Act, or Colorado Outdoor Recreation Economy Act. And it's part of the act, and we're hoping that the CORE Act, which was recently reintroduced to Congress, finds its way through and becomes not just a bill, but law. The second type of mineral withdrawal is called an administrative mineral withdrawal, and this is done essentially through the White House. It travels from the Bureau of Land Management and ends up in front of President Biden, who would then sign it. The difference between the legislative mineral withdrawal and the administrative mineral withdrawal is that the legislative, which is in the CORE Act, would be forever. The administrative withdrawal would only be for 20 years. But because the process has actually begun on the administrative withdrawal, the mining claims are essentially locked up. They can't issue any new ones until they come up with a decision whether or not to issue the administrative withdrawal. So both of them we'd like to see go through. Of course, the legislative would supersede the administrative. So if the legislative mineral withdrawal happened, there would be no new mining claims issued on Red Lady for life. Condition number three, Dave. It's around water. The company that's one of our partners is called Mount Emmons Mining Company. They're the ones with the claims. And we do want Mount Emmons Mining Company to have enough water to continue to do reclamation at what's called the Historic Keystone Mine, a legacy mine that's on their property, and they're basically responsible for it. So we would like them to have enough water to continue to clean it up and to, you know, minimize the pollution. But we would like the rest of their conditional water rights for mining to just flow downhill, drain into either the Slate River or the Coal Creek or Obi Joyful Creek. These are all creeks that kind of flank Mount Emmons. So we'd like them to have enough water to finish up their work with reclamation, but then we want the rest of it to come down and be a part of the watershed. So the three conditions, again, no mining on Red Lady. This is where a land exchange leads to a conservation easement. A mineral withdrawal, which is what removes new claims from being issued, and then water rights. You know, we just want as much water as possible to go back into our waterways.
Crested Butte has a big history as a mining town. And when, like, a group of young people in the late 60s, early 70s began to be like a new generation discovering this place, there were a lot of old-time miners from coal mines up there. So do you feel like these generations worked together to protect this land? Or is there kind of a tension where the desire for mining is there because of, you know, the economic impacts it could have for jobs?
Well, initially there were some of the old-time residents who had worked in mines who did want to see a mine come back. They didn't quite grasp, I don't believe, that the scale of mining that was being proposed would overshadow anything they ever were involved with. They were mostly involved in coal mining, and molybdenum mining is a whole different animal, and it really would have denigrated the waterways in several different valleys here and would have been just turned this area into a major industrial zone rather than what we have now. And back in the day, we all thought, well, we're going to make a choice here. It's going to be mining or tourism. We chose tourism. And it has, even with, you know, whatever little downsides it might have, it still is a better choice than what mining would have been. And the other piece of that is back when the mines were operating, everybody had jobs here. Yes, but in 1952, when the mines closed, there was nothing. There was no way to make a living here, and people left in droves. So the boom-bust cycle, we did not want to see repeated. And some of the old miners got it. They really did. They were essentially with us. But it was, you know, it wasn't 100%. But more and more as time went on, the whole community pretty much was on board.
Also, Dave, kind of as time went on, I think folks realized that these very large, giant mining companies have their own labor force, and the local labor force isn't guaranteed a job. Because you know how to drive heavy machinery or something doesn't mean you're going to work for the mine. They have people all over the world doing this elsewhere, and they could just bring them in. Like, so I think people kind of wised up and knew that, sure, they might have sold more gasoline, but the people here weren't guaranteed to get a job. And especially those who were up to this day working in either the recreation industry or health or the arts or the other things that are here in Crested Butte. We have a semi-regular economy in addition to a tourism economy. Those folks wouldn't just be reassigned jobs up at the mine. So that's also when the argument about how great it is for the economy, I think we have to remember who's living here now and is it great for them?
That's very interesting. So that's part of the boom cycle. When a major industry comes to town, it imports its own skilled labor. And those are the very same people that will then disappear if the mine closes. Now, one of the tensions explored in the film is certainly about housing and how difficult it is for people who work in, as you're describing, the tourist industry or other, you know, service aspects of town to find a place to live. Like, how has the real estate world changed, Sue, in all of your time?
Well,
here?
That's probably one of our biggest, if not the biggest, problem now. It's gotten so expensive to live here that people are actually having to leave. If you didn't already get a place or have a place to rent securely, you are not guaranteed a place to live. A lot more short-term rentals have happened in recent years, and it's hard for long-term locals, and it's the labor market is suffering as a result. So, and so are seniors, I might add, as property values go sky high and taxes go sky high with them.
Dave, let me give you a little example. I haven't been around Crested Butte as long as Sue. I moved here in 2005. And when I moved here, you could have opened the classifieds and seen how many places were for rent. And oftentimes there were more of those than jobs in the paper. If you wanted to just move across to the other side of town as a renter, just to see what it was like to live on the east side, you wouldn't have had a problem finding a place. Now, finding a place is extremely difficult, if not impossible, maybe more expensive than you can even reasonably make here in town to pay for it. And like, if you can possibly find a place, you're going to hang on to that for dear life. You're not going to be looking to move across town just for fun. Housing is extremely tight and extremely difficult for a lot of people.
So you mentioned short-term housing. That sounds to me like the Airbnb type of places. Is that what's happening to the housing stock?
In part, yeah. In part, just the real estate values, you know, things have escalated so much that the average person, even working a decent job, will likely never be able to afford to buy a house here. And yeah, it's a common thing. It's a common ailment of most communities in Colorado, I would say, if not in other states as well. When a place gets really popular, it gets really expensive.
Dave, think about it like this. For a long time, there were a lot of rentals available in Crested Butte. and people you would call in the service industry that work in tourism and whatnot. They're the folks most often renting instead of purchasing because they, A, they're just not making a competitive wage to buy, even when before property values went haywire. But they're also renting maybe because they're only going to be here seasonally. But these people are an integral part of our economy. Without them, we don't have a tourism economy. And so when property values started to rise and people were encouraged basically to sell their homes for, I mean, why wouldn't you? You just made a lot of money off the value of your home. Why not? I understand why people make that decision. And
go ahead, Dave.
So Dave, if you decided to sell your home, and maybe it housed, it was a rental used to house five or six people in the tourism industry, that removes housing for that many people. You do that five times, there goes 30 employees. That's an entire shop. You do that 10 more times, there goes a good chunk of your local labor force.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Sue Navy, the board president of High Country Conservation Advocates, and Chad Rich, the executive director. They are bringing the film High Country to Boulder on Friday at the Patagonia store. And Chad, I understand you will be in Boulder to do a presentation.
Yeah, Dave. So I'm going to speak before the film for about 5 minutes. And we'll talk about some of the issues we're facing here in conservation and environmental, in the environmental world here in Crested Butte and Gunnison County. Our organization does operate throughout the entire county. We don't just have the Red Lady Project going on. We also work in stewardship, in restoration, on water issues, and on many public lands issues. So the organization has grown throughout the years to host many different programs, but we're most well known for the Red Lady issue. I'll be there to talk about some of our other programs, how we work to improve habitat for the Gunnison sage grouse, which is listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. We'll talk about some of our work to restore wetlands, and we'll talk about, of course, the Red Lady issue. And I'll be there along with the film's producer, which I'd like to mention, Connor Hagen, will also be there to present the film, and he'll be able to tell filmgoers so much more about the process of making it and the issues kind of he uncovered as he produced it.
So Sue Navy, with your experience with community organizing and staying involved in this main issue for, you know, almost half a century at this point, what is some of your accumulated wisdom that you could share with people that are, you know, engaged in environmental fights against well-moneyed, deep-pocketed corporations?
I would say stay with it. No matter, you know, what you're told from the get-go, if people say you'll never win this, just stay with it. That's what we did. We persevered. We're still persevering. 46 years, and we're getting close to resolution. I just would say, don't give up. There's a possibility. There's always a chance of winning.
Do you think there's something special about the community that you're part of there in Crested Butte that allows for that kind of tenacity and seeing the long road?
I guess I would say yes. I'm not sure what makes that tenacity, but we seem to have it, and it seems to have been working all this time. It hasn't worked on every level all the time, but it has worked on the Red Lady issue. So I'm really glad that we have the kind of support, the kind of mentality, the kind of energy it takes to keep something going for this many years and not backing down.
So in real time, what is the legacy of your work there? I mean, when you go outside, do you feel like this is the area that I'm taking care of? This area takes care of me and I take care of it.
I couldn't have said it any better, Dave. That's exactly how I feel. I look as though I was put here for that very reason, you know, to take care of this place that has given me a really fulfilling life, and I wouldn't have traded it for anything. And I will continue to do the very best I can to protect this place for as long as I can.
So how does that look? What have you prevented, and what are the fruits of that? What do you see?
I'd say the fruits are we still have a thriving and beautiful environment, economy, population, all the community really wanted. And the community is still a community. That's an important factor. We haven't lost our sense of self, and we continue to embrace one another and feel part of one another's lives. It's still a small town. As much as it's grown, it's still a small town, and it still takes care of, we take care of our own. We take care of other people too.
How does it feel to see that history reflected in a film?
For me, it's awe-inspiring. I mean, to have a film telling what essentially is the story of my life, personally, it's really special. It's emotional. I've seen the film about 10 times, and I'll see it every chance I get. It's a beautiful film. And, you know, I want to emphasize, too, that I know that a lot of people in Boulder or Denver come to Crested Butte. This we know, and people love it here. And it's a great refuge from the urban centers. And with all of that, I hope people will come see the film, because it'll give you a little background on what brought Crested Butte to be the place that you love now, and what we've done to contribute to that.
That's wonderful. A little history, a little context for all of us here that might need to know more about what is so unique about Crested Butte. I've been up to some radio conferences there at our wonderful partner station, KBUT, and I'd like to shout out the crew over there, particularly Court Support. And do you have some shout outs before we close things out here on It's the Economy?
Shout out to all our supporters, wherever they may live, and to Connor Hagen, who made this film, which was a labor of love on his part. His partner in doing this was Allie Batwin. I believe she's in Boulder as well. So I hope she comes that evening. Those are people who really have highlighted all the work that's gone into what otherwise could be easily be forgotten, but it's on film now. It's also in a book by Paul Anderson, and that book is called The Town That Said Hell No, and it's a really interesting story of the past 50 years. Highly recommend it.
Folks, you can check out High Country for yourselves at the Patagonia store tomorrow evening, Friday. Go to the Patagonia store website to find out more event details. Sue Navy, Board President of High Country Conservation Advocates, and Chad Rich, Executive Director. Thank you so much for joining us this evening on It's the Economy.
Thank you so much, Dave. It's been a pleasure.
It's great to be on KGNU, Dave.
That's going to wrap up our show on It's the Economy here this evening. Thanks for tuning in. I hope that your appetite has been whetted to check out some activist documentaries happening again. Healing US is at the Alamo Draft House in Denver on West Colfax on next Tuesday. Tomorrow, you can see High Country at the Patagonia store in Denver. Like to thank my guests, Sue Navy, Chad Rich, Laura Fielding, Maddie Purvis, and Sarah Wright. This is Dave Ashton. It's been fun hanging out, doing the thing. Get out of the house, go see a movie, and get involved. Get in the streets. Go get it. Stay tuned for Highway 322. Till next time, let the dollar suck an egg.
K KGNU FM 88.5 Boulder, KGNU 1390 Denver.
Support comes from Redstone Meadery, presenting Nectars, Honey Wines, and Reserves. Redstone Meadery's tasting room is located at 4700 Pearl Street in Boulder. More information can be found at redstonemeadery.com.
Support for the Charles Saltell Memorial Mountain Jam comes from Rats Woodshack Barbecue, taking place on Sunday, July 16th at the Gold Hill Inn from noon to 4 p.m. Doors open at 11:30. Tickets and a full list of performers can be found at kgnu.org.
Come celebrate the 35th year of the Charles Memorial Mountain Jam, featuring Jake Legg, the Pine Creek Cajun Band, and the Cody Sisters. It's great music and great food from the side yard of the historic Gold Hill Inn. And all proceeds benefit KGNU. Get your tickets now at kgnu.org.
Hi, folks. Welcome to Highway 322 with Damon.
Oh, Krusty Radio Man.
I found